Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At Sephora, we know how you love to use makeup, skincare, hair care, and fragrances that work for you, but also how important it is to be in the know about the ingredients that are in them, which is why we created Clean at Sephora. Curated products from brands like Merit, Amika, Summer Fridays, and Fleur that have everything you want, minus certain ingredients you might not. Clean at Sephora is only at Sephora. Shop now at Sephora.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. We are joined today by Robert Louis Wilkin. He is Emeritus Professor at the University of Virginia, the William R. Kennan Professor of the History of Christianity. He has several books to his credit, many books, in fact, among them The First Thousand Years, The Spirit of Early Christian Thought, and The Christians as the Romans Saw Them. But we are joined by him today to discuss his latest book, which is entitled Liberty in the Things of God, The Christian Origins of Religious Freedom. Mr. Wilkin, thank you so much for joining us on New Books Network.
My pleasure.
So this is a, as you stated in the beginning of the book, a kind of a revisionist history of religious freedom and its origins. So can you explain your thesis and how it differs from is the prevailing or dominant view?
Well, the prevailing view is that religious freedom was the work of the Enlightenment. In fact, just a few weeks ago, back in March, Robert Kagan, a very well-known political commentator and historian, had an op-ed piece in the Washington Post in which he said precisely that, that it was because of the religious wars that people got very tired of religious groups fighting with one another. And so in that setting, then they began to think of ways in which the governments, particularly in Western Europe, would be able to make possible people of differing religious convictions to live together without killing one another. I think I have the quotation right here. I mean, just read it to you. Only with the advent of Enlightenment liberalism did people begin to believe that the individual conscience, as well as the individual's body, should be inviolate and protected from the intrusions of state and church. That's Robert Kagan's view. What I show in this book is that the origins of that particular notion, namely the liberty of conscience, really reach way back into Western history, in particular to the writings of early Christians in the second and third and fourth century, particularly in the Roman Empire. And even though their arguments about the need for freedom to choose in religious matters was stated very clearly, it didn't really have a lot of effect on what happened in the Middle Ages, because as the society then became a Christian society, Christians dealt with dissenters, particularly heretics, Jews, and others, in pretty much the same way in which they had been treated by the Romans. So the real argument of the book is that ideas that had been set forth in the early centuries, drawing in part on the scriptures, didn't really have a profound effect on Christian thinking behavior until the 16th century. that is, with the beginning of the various reformations in Europe. And when that happened, and Christians were persecuting Christians, they began to read the older texts with fresh eyes. And fortunately, because of the Renaissance and humanism, many of them were freshly edited. And so ideas which had been first advanced in the early centuries began to be recycled and to be rethought and applied to new situations. So it's really a story that begins early in Western history, but then really gets its momentum in the 16th century and then the 17th century. The point that I want to make is that what developed in terms of religious freedom and liberty of conscience was not really a political idea. It was a religious idea, and it was religious people who realized that if you were a religious person, that was something that was within you, deep within your heart and your mind, and there was no way you could trace that by external means. That's basically the idea.
Okay, so you trace this intellectual history all the way back to the earliest days of the church in the late 2nd century AD, or I guess we now call it the Common Era. And in regard to particular theologians, commentators, these are people like Tertullian, Lactantius. And so this is really a tracing of an origin of an idea. And then you also, what you're doing is tracing out how that idea was received. So this notion of religious freedom, what did that mean to the early church fathers?
Well, first of all, the term itself, liberty of religion, was first used by Tertullian of Carthage, a Christian writer living in North Africa, which would be present-day Tunisia. But what he said was this. He said, it is only just and a privilege inherent in human nature that every person should be able to worship according to his own convictions. The religious practice of one person neither harms nor helps another. It is not part of religion to coerce religious practice, for it is by choice, not coercion, that we should be led to religion. And that was the basic conception that was first advanced in the third century. So what the key points are that religion must be a matter of choice, of an inner conviction. And for that reason, it can't be coerced by external means, by the sword or by any other means of that sort. So that's really the core idea. But then it gets developed and amplified. One of the things that appears fairly early is the notion of conscience. Conscience was a term that had been used by Greeks and Romans, Stoics, Seneca, for example. Conscience comes from the Latin word scientia, which means knowledge, and then con, which is knowledge with, and it really meant an awareness, more like consciousness, of what one had done. And if you had done things that were good, you had a good conscience, and if you had done things that were evil, you had an evil conscience. But what happens with Christian thinkers, and the first one really to begin to use the term, a Christian writer, the Apostle Paul, conscience becomes a guide to future actions, not just a recollection of what one had done, but a kind of tutor as to how one should behave. And then that gets developed in the Middle Ages, Thomas Aquinas, and then all of a sudden begins to appear in writings of Christians of many different communions, not of any one communion, Catholics, Protestants, Evangelicals, Anabaptists, to mean that you could not force a person to act against their deepest conviction, which meant their conscience.
And so at the time that these arguments are being made by Tertullian and then almost a century later by Lactantius, who's the one that you refer to as developing the concept of conscience as a distinct concept, way of knowledge, you know, the root there, conscience, is scienter, the Latin word for knowledge. And this is a knowledge that is divinely inspired knowledge, right? In other words, this is not knowledge gained from experience per se, but rather it's divinely has divine origins.
Yes, that's certainly the conviction, though it, like all knowledge, it's formed by experience, and it was formed by living within a community of people who believe certain things. We use the term, you know, well-formed conscience, but basically conscience then was an obligation one had to God, not to oneself. And that's why I make the point along the way that it's not a right of private judgment. It's really a statement of one's obedience to God. And that, of course, would be known through the scriptures and through the church's traditions and faith.
And so what was the motive? You mentioned Tertullian. He's really, I guess, the earliest figure, aside from the writers of the Gospels, who develops this idea of freedom to believe, or the freedom of belief. What was the context in which Tertullian was writing that? What's the motive for him to write this?
Well, he lived in a community that was being persecuted. And actually, one of the most famous historical moments in the history of persecution of Christians in the Roman Empire took place in his own city of Carthage. It was the martyrdom of, or the passion of, Perpetua and Felicity, two women who were killed in the theater, the Colosseum in their city, and he may have been responsible for writing an account of that martyrdom, which is one of the most famous and one of the ones that's most widely read of early Christian martyrs. And so it was a very, for him, it was an existential matter. Namely, the people in his own community were being killed. The social situation was that religion in the ancient world was an affair of the community as a whole. And so, and what that meant was that the community as a whole had public ritual acts, most notably the offering of sacrifices, the roasting of a bull or a lamb. And so all the people in the city then participated in these things. It took place outside. If you ever travel through the Mediterranean world, the altar where sacrifice took place was in front of the temple. Unlike the Christians who had an altar in the temple or in the church. And so it's a very public matter. And so when they had these sacrifices, the Christians were noticeably absent. And so the people resented it. It's really as simple as that. The community expected that everyone would participate in the public religious rituals.
So throughout the Mediterranean world, where Christianity has begun to spread in this 2nd and 3rd century AD, you have a belabored, persecuted community of Christians, of course. And then a change occurs around the early 4th century with, most famously, 313, with the Edict of Milan, which, of course, you point out is not merely a toleration of Christians. It's not restricted to Christians per se. It's essentially a religious toleration in the broader sense. And so explain how important this Edict of Milan is, both for Christians and for the Roman Empire as a public, in terms of public religion.
It's really not an edict, it's a letter, and the term edict is kind of fixed to it, but it was an actual letter of Constantine, who was the first Christian emperor, and another emperor by the name of Licinius. And it was an effort to try to bring some order into the disorder that the presence of Christianity had brought. And what it does is it acknowledges the right or the freedom of people who belong to religions that are different from what's publicly acknowledged are able to practice their religion without interruption. And it makes it very clear that it applies not only to Christians, but to all others. The truth of the matter is that it didn't have much of an impact because as the decades went by, toward the end of the 4th century, another Roman emperor by the name of Theodosius proclaims that the religion of everyone living in the empire should be Christianity. And so then what you have is a beginning of a new Christian society. And over time, that meant that those people who were not Christians or who were not Orthodox Christians were marginalized. And the people who suffered the most were the Jews, not so much in overt ways, but gradually just pushing them off to the side of society. So the document is a very significant one, but it is not one that had a lot of impact in the decades and generations that followed. It's not until the 16th and 17th century that people begin to remember and to talk about it and to quote it. So it's very significant, but like, you know, many things in history, just because they look significant to us, they weren't so significant to the contemporaries.
And so as the Roman Empire becomes essentially a Christian-dominated empire, we also have, of course, eventually, not long after this happens, we have the decline of the empire and its dissolution. And so as the Middle Ages begin, what's the status of dissenting religions in these different communities?
Well, first of all, the empire, what happened by, say, the year 500, you really had two empires. You had one that was in the east, that would be the Eastern Mediterranean, and be Greece, Asia Minor, which is Turkey, Egypt. That continued on, and the center was Constantinople. But in the west, the empire really came to an end, you know, a little before the year 500. And what begins to develop is a new Western Christian society, primarily in France, what became France, what became Germany and Britain and Italy. And there, Christianity was the dominant religion. The great figure there, of course, was Charlemagne, roughly around the year 800. And what the society did is it allowed the Jews to continue to practice their religion, but with restrictions. So, for example, they didn't like the Jews building new synagogues. They didn't like the synagogues to be close to a church. One bishop complained because we could hear them chanting, you know, when we're having our liturgy. And so gradually the society began to marginalize the Jews. And then as the centuries went by and with the rise of the Crusades, which were really concerned about the Middle East, the Crusades, the idea of a crusade to recover lands that had been captured by the Muslims, so inflamed the people in Western Europe, and then they began really seriously to persecute the Jews. And that's the inheritance that, of course, we now live with in our Western society. It's a very sad chapter in the history of Western civilization and, of course, a very sad chapter in the history of Christianity.
So as the Western Empire declines and breaks up and is dominated by different Germanic tribes, the religion of Christianity, of course, is still, is it spreading still?
Of course.
And so, I mean, yes, go ahead.
Well, I mean, that's one of the great stories is it spread to Britain, the British Isles. It spread into the Scandinavian countries, and then it spread into the Germanic tribes on the other side of the Elbe River, and then eventually it begins to move further east into Poland. And so Poland was missionized from the west. That's why Poland is historically a Catholic country. And those lands that were east of Poland, Bulgaria, for example, and then, of course, the Russian lands, they were missionized from Constantinople, and that's why they are Eastern Orthodox Christians. So the mission really extended well into the 12th and the 13th century. And by by the 13th century, pretty much all of Western and Eastern Europe was now Christian.
And so as Christianity is spreading throughout Europe, is there a need at all, with the exception of the Jewish question, is there a need to tolerate or deal with any kind of dissent?
Well, yes, and you can read Thomas Aquinas is always a very, very rich source. And the issues that arose were twofold. One is people who did not hold all of the one who was brought to because he's not Orthodox. So that would be one case. And so you've got a number of those that during the high and the late Middle Ages. And then as mentioned, Jews. And here again, the principle that was set forth earlier was clearly observed, namely that you can't force a person to become a Christian, and you can't force a Jewish parent to baptize their child. So there were some safeguards. But again, the pressure in this society was really to have a uniform religious observance, which is what most cities and towns had. So then there was always a dissenting presence, Jewish or
parent. But does that presence force any development?
Very little, very little. That's why the point that I make in the book is that it was the Reformation. And the phrase that I use, it's a phrase that I got reading Shakespeare. It was the rough torrent of occasion, the rough torrent of occasion. And it was the rough torrent of occasion. And so the first real instance where you begin to find an appeal to freedom of conscience, curiously, is a monastery of women, convent in Nuremberg. Nuremberg was close to Wittenberg, and the Reformation came there early, and the city magistrates took over religious affairs in the city, pretty much pushed the bishop aside, and so they began to dismantle the monasteries. And this one abbess, a woman named Charitas Pirkheimer, wrote a journal week by week of what they were doing to close the community, shut it down. And she then says, it's kind of strange that here we got the reformers telling us that they have to have the freedom of the gospel, and they won't allow us to practice what we believe and to follow, as she uses the word, our conscience. So it's curious that the first, in the Reformation, the first person to appeal to liberty of conscience is a Catholic nun.
And so she's doing this simultaneous with the arguments that Luther is making. And this is the break point, as you identify it, in terms of how the public concept of religious observance, religious practice, really brings this division within the community. In other words, this appears to be pretty quickly not just a debate about the form that the church should take as an institution, but also whether you can even have simultaneous different practices in the same community, right?
Yes, and it's very significant. I even quote another sister who believed belonged to that same community, who said, "Here I stand, I cannot do otherwise." And it sounds like she's mimicking Luther. We don't know whether Luther actually said that. But the point being, and this I think is very important, is that whether you were a Protestant or whether you were a Catholic, they were all drawing on common Christian materials that had been developed in the early and the Middle Ages. So you can't say, I mean, some people think that religious freedom began with the Baptists in the 17th century, but it goes back earlier than that. And the other thing that you mentioned, which is important, is also in the city of Nuremberg, early on with the Reformation, you began to have some people who wanted a more radical Reformation than Martin Luther did. They were what we call them Anabaptists, which is what Baptist comes from. That is, they wanted to rebaptize. They didn't believe in baptism of children. And so they began to form their own communities, elect their own clergy, and to be independent. Very significant, because what it means is that the development of religious freedom is as much about the rights of religious communities as it is about the rights of individuals. And then that, as the decades go by, become much more important in the debates. They're really not concerned about what a certain individual will believe, but they were concerned that they didn't want to have a disruptive religious fellowship in the midst of their cities.
And that seems to be one of the key concerns in these debates, is the notion of peace and good order.
Yes, the conviction was, and it had been deeply immersed in society for centuries, that you can't have peace and order in a society if you have more than one religion. And it's hard for us to imagine, because we don't know any other world, but almost everyone took that as self-evident.
And so what's the dissident's response to that? In other words, that peace and good order has to be, requires uniformity of faith and observance and practice. And so the dissident's argument in response to this is what?
Well, the argument was is that you have to grant that there are religious convictions that are a matter of conscience, and these need to be respected. Actually, one of the most interesting persons that I read was a man named Jean Bodin. And he uses the word association, collegium in Latin, to talk about associations of physicians or lawyers or plumbers or whatever, and also religious association. He said the difference between the religious associations and the others is that their community is organized around their beliefs, their convictions, which are a matter of conscience. So what he in fact is saying, he's not a great proponent of religious freedom. He says you have to deal with religious communities differently than others because they have convictions that are based on conscience.
And so it's in this context in the early 16th century when, as you mentioned earlier, we have the recovery of the arguments of people like Tertullian and Lactantius, and their arguments regarding conscience and concepts that are basically recovered by these theologians are active in these debates, right?
Yeah, so what you have then is a kind of a new burst of intellectual fervor as people try to work out the terms on which they hope society would recognize the rights of independent religious fellowships. Call them sects, we would call them churches. And there were very different ways in which, and then in which they made the case.
And so when these debates are occurring, it's not just the abstract concept of conscience, but also it's really where they're utilizing biblical texts. So you talk about, for example, the recovery of St. Augustine's use of a passage from the book of Luke, where he talks about compelling people to come in. And then there's also the point, the quote, famous quote of rendering unto Caesar from the book of Matthew, which is from Jesus himself. And so these are all utilized in this context of this debate, right?
Well, yeah, as it became clear that what the central issue was, the status, the privileges, the rights of a religious community, then people realized that you had then to say something about the distinction between religious fellowship and civic fellowship. And so the biblical text of render unto Caesar and to God, things that are of God, becomes one text that is used. And so they talk about the ends, that is the purposes of a religious community and purposes of a civic community are completely different. And one of the nice phrases that appears regularly is that the civic authorities have no cognizance of religious matters. That is, that they don't have any say in religious matters. And up to that point, everyone assumed that political authorities, the civic authorities, did have a say in religious matters. And that really is, you know, the source of our later notions of the separation of church and state.
And so that brings me to the point that we've been alluding to but haven't discussed forthright, which is, what is the status of, and I know this is a jam-packed question in terms of what it begs for as an answer, but what is really the status of the separation of church and state by the 16th century? As we understood it, of course, we talked about the official religion of the Roman Empire after Theodosius is Christianity, and that is essentially the model that's being used up through this time, right? And so...
I can mention two figures here. First of all, there are a string of Baptist writers. The most famous is Roger Williams, who, of course, founded Rhode Island. One who is less known is a man named John Owen. He was in Britain. He was a dissenter. And the issue was, under English law, in, say, the 1600s, you were required to go to the parish church. You were not allowed, and you were fined if you didn't, you were not allowed to gather a group of people independently, get together to read the Bible, have someone preach, celebrate Holy Communion. And so what happened was, is that there needed to be an argument that conscience had to do with more than what a person's inner belief was. Everybody agreed that you can't really touch what a person believes internally, but you can regulate what they do externally in terms of religious practice. And several writers, one that I was particularly interested in is a man named John Owen. He said, no, conscience has to do with not only what you hold in your heart, but it has to do with what you do. In other words, conscience requires action. And so that was his way of saying that you cannot impose on people what they will do, must do, in religious matters. That's something that is up to the individual and the community to which he belongs. And so he really cuts through and says we have to keep these two distinct. And then, of course, John Locke basically gives the same argument that you have to keep the ends of the civic authorities from the ends of religious communities. If religious communities are there to praise and worship God, and the civic community is there to provide safety, security, preserve property, et cetera, et cetera.
Now, of course, one of the points you make is that the Reformation itself ultimately strengthens the state because the unity of the church is broken, and that means there's essentially less toleration in the respective regions where Protestantism versus Catholicism becomes even stronger in its association with the state, right? In other words...
Yes, and that's very, very significant, because what happened is... Once you, let's take the Lutheran lands, once you dispense with the bishop, then it's the prince or the magistrates who have the authority to regulate religious matters, so that the church then becomes, or the churches, just become communities that are concerned only about their internal affairs. And of course, the magistrates had a great interest in regulating religion, and so they are strengthened. And the church loses, a phrase that I use is they have authority but no dominion. They can only regulate their own people. And the magistrates, you know, that we can regulate everybody because we're the people who run the government. And that, of course, was very much the case in England. And that's why so much of the literature comes out of England in the 17th century, which is, of course, where John Locke was.
Now, can you, is England a special case? I mean, in some ways, obviously it is, but is it a special case because of the initial formal reasons for the break with Rome?
I suppose it is, and for a very simple reason is that when Henry VIII in the early 16th century broke with Rome, basically he established the king or the queen as the primary religious as well as political authority. And so you had really a national church. You no longer had a pope, you had bishops, but the bishops were, of course, under the king. And so England then becomes, in a way, the most, not so much the most repressive, though in some ways it was, of all the territories in the regions within Europe, because the political and the religious authority were now put in the hands of the king or the queen. So there was an appeal then that was possible.
Yeah, so what's striking to me is in terms of the ideas that come out of what will eventually become the Civil War in the 1630s and 40s is this concept of a fear of civil war, which, of course, most famously motivates Thomas Hobbes in his book. And, of course, Hobbes is not really a concern of yours in this book because he's not primarily concerned with faith and liberty of conscience, as Locke is. But it was striking to me, and this, I guess, is kind of an aside, it's just striking to me that England seems to be this special case where they go from one extreme to the other. It's either extremely Catholic and repressive, or it's extremely Church of England and repressive, not so much per se Protestant.
Yeah, that's well put. Church of England and repressive, that should still be not the model, you know, that people think of the Church of England. But it was very repressive on all dissenters, not only the Baptists but the Catholics, and it's in large measure because of the nature of English society and its religious and political makeup that so much of the literature that develops notions of religious freedom, so much of that literature was written by Englishmen.
And of course, one of the other areas you as you deal with. I want listeners to understand that this is not just about Germany and England. It's also about the Netherlands and their revolt. And that plays a really important historical role because you describe how the civil war or the rebellion in the Netherlands from rule by Spain in the 16th century is also instrumental in creating this area what will eventually become a degree of tolerance in the Netherlands that ultimately will impact English society itself. So can you explain how these historical contexts are really shaping this debate about public religious observance?
Well, Netherlands was very important because you had the Calvinists, who were the primary Protestant religious groups in the Netherlands. And as the decades went by, the late 16th century, particularly in the north, these then established themselves as the religion of their city or their territory. And as a result of that, some then began to develop arguments that you have to respect. In fact, they use the term, religion is never simply a private matter. And it's not enough simply to grant people liberty of conscience, but you have to allow them space for the exercise of religion. Now, I'm not sure that that's the first time that phrase occurs, but when I read it, I was astounded because I hadn't really seen it up to that point. This would be around 1580. And so what happens then as the English situation becomes more repressive, Englishmen then move to the Netherlands, and they then begin to pick up ideas from the the Calvinists and the Anabaptists who are in the Netherlands, and then they bring those back to England. So there's, you know, it's very close. So the Netherlands become then an important source and for the English dissidents and the English Baptists. And I discussed a couple of these people there. In fact, one of the most significant things that I ran across was that there was a Dutch writer by the name of Twisk, who wrote a huge book of citations from earlier Christian writers on religious freedom and liberty of conscience. So Holland becomes then the kind of a nub, a center that influenced particularly English dissidents.
And I was also thinking of, you mentioned this other writer, Dirk Cornhert. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Cornhert, yes. He was a major Calvinist figure. And I don't really deal with him at greater length because I had other sources that were able to make the point. But he clearly was one of the major figures. And there is an interesting debate that he had with a magistrate. And the question really turned precisely on that, is that whether you could allow people to gather and practice their faith independently of what the city as a whole held to. He's a key figure in that regard.
Well, one point that was striking to me, one theme that was striking to me, and this is just my reader's perception, and I'm curious if this resonates with you as well.
The reader's perception is the most important.
Well, I'm curious if this notion of peace and good order, both sides, in my impression during the Reformation, use it to the best effect they can. In other words, the reformers argue, in response to the claim of the dominant Catholics as they're responding to the Reformation, Catholics argue you can't have dissent because otherwise you're breaking apart the community. It's one and the same. It's hand in glove. The French, I think that you quote the famous French line, one king, one law, one faith. But on the other side, the reformers argue that you need to have toleration of these different sects in order to achieve peace. And so this goal of obtaining public peace and the absence of strife in ultimately what does become civil war, it seems to be one of the motivating factors in pushing these arguments forward.
Well, everybody realized the importance of order, good order, and public peace. And so the question that underlies all of these debates is, can you have such order, such peace, such stability, if people have fundamental disagreements on matters of religion that lead to formation of independent religious communities? Again, I have to keep emphasizing, it is the independent communities. Religious belief of individuals, that doesn't count for much. There are some instances where it does count. But it has to do with whether you're splitting up the community so that people who live on the same block are going to different fellowships when they want to pray. And they couldn't see how that was possible to have that and still maintain good order. And I think that's present in our world today.
Right. And so I see that connection, and you draw that connection to our world today near the end of the book when you talk about the conceptualization of religious freedom in the American context. And I want to get to that in a moment. But what was striking to me is that this need and obvious perception that public order is achieved through toleration, it seems to be, and this is the part that I want to ask you about, is that need for public order the key to understanding how the debate about conscience moves from simply a concern with individuals, the original concern that perhaps Tertullian had, to the concern for a political right, meaning a freedom from government interference? Is that need for public order and concern for groups something that was present in the minds of the writers in the 17th and 18th century?
Well, it certainly was in the minds of the people that I mentioned, in Roger Williams, John Owen, John Locke. I mean, that was the issue that most exercised him. And so you keep using the word toleration, as you know, because you have read the book and you've read it very carefully, I can see, is I tried to avoid that word because toleration, in its historic sense, and I think in its core meaning, is a right, or at least a privilege, or an accommodation that the ruling authorities give to religious communities. I tried to emphasize that religious freedom and liberty of conscience was a right that was a natural endowment, not something that the government gives. If the government gives, it can take it away. So I think, and not everybody, of course, saw that so clearly. I don't think John Locke saw that so clearly. And Jefferson says we have to go further than him. But Roger Williams saw it, John Owen saw it, and others saw it. So that's, I think, an important qualification that needs to be made.
And so as the 17th century progresses, of course, we're concerned with the American colonies and the motives for different people migrating to American colonies. And by the time the Revolution occurs, you've got multiple different states, former colonies, that have their own public churches. So how does this notion of religious dissent, as it had developed in 17th century England and Netherlands, how's that impacting, so to speak, American, maybe not be a unified American?
Well, I have an epilogue that deals with that. My primary historical work has been on the ancient world and, to a certain extent, the Middle Ages. And so in some ways, this book was moving into a territory that was relatively unknown to me. And so I was able to feel comfortable coming up as far as Locke was concerned. But I realized when I got to the American colonies that would be a bit much for me to go too deeply into this. And so I simply wanted to make a couple of points. And the point that I make is this. If you go to 18th century Virginia, and you go to James Madison, who lived in central Virginia. He lived near Culpeper, in a little town close to Orange. The established religion was Anglicanism. And what happened in the 18th century, this is with the Great Awakening, is you began to have Baptists moving into the territory and, of course, winning converts from the Anglican churches, which were apparently not very religiously vibrant. And so the authorities began to arrest Baptists who met together to preach, sing, pray, and put them in jail. And it was that problem that Madison had to address. And he took an interest in how the state of Virginia, or the colony of Virginia, would deal with these dissidents. And then he wrote this memorial and remonstrance, which was really prompted because Patrick Henry wanted to extend, his way of dealing with the problem was to extend the governmental support to others besides the Anglicans. And Madison thought that was really abhorrent. And so he wrote, and he then wrote this memorial and remonstrance, a very, very famous document, and he makes two points. One point is that religious convictions are internal beliefs that are a matter of conscience, and so therefore they have to be privileged. And secondly, that the civil authorities have no cognizance, even uses the word, of religious matters. And that then becomes really the foundation on which American jurisprudence deals with these questions. And so you have implicitly there the separation of church and state. I don't know whether you noticed, one of the things that I was really most pleased with, I ran across this document by a man named Philip Fourneau. Did you know that name?
Yes, yes.
Had you read Fourneau?
I haven't read his work in the original, no, but I've certainly read references.
And you're not talking about Fourneau. This is Fourneau.
No, not the publisher. No, not the publisher. We're talking about the...
Well, when I ran across that work, I discovered the name, I think, reading Meacham's biography of Madison, and I got very curious, and I was able to get a hold of the work, and it's very, and Madison, when he learned about it, it was published in the 1780s. When he learned about it, he had his friend, Bradford, to get him a copy. And it's almost, and this Fourneau says, you know, Locke is the man, and everyone is now following his ideas. And then he lays out these two basic principles, namely that religious convictions are a matter of conscience, and that the state does have no authority in these in such matters. And so it's a kind of a natural bridge between Locke and Madison. So I consider Fourneau really a key player in the development of the American colonial thinkers. But as I
right, and just to clarify, this is the Fourneau. He is actually based in, he lives in England.
He was in England, and he was dealing with a similar problem in England, that is trying to find space for dissenters. And so he's a fairly important figure in his time. So, as I say it, for me, you know, it was not being really totally familiar with all these materials, to find somebody who provided a direct link between John Locke and Madison, that was for me very uplifting. Yes.
And you also mentioned, of course, Thomas Jefferson's famous phrase that another's religion neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. And this is certainly referring back to the concept that peace is obtained through freedom. And it's this separated, this concept that we now today think of popularly as separation of church and state. It's really, it's liberty of conscience.
It is. And of course, you know, you're a historian. You know, you spend years, and this was one of those discoveries, because Jefferson, when he wrote his book, Notes on the State of Virginia, he was not aware of some of the things that that I've been talking about here. But later, he discovered this passage from Tertullian. And then he wrote a person in Richmond who was selling some books, and one of them was this work of Tertullian. So if you go to the University of Virginia, to the library, the rare book library, you find Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia. And at the point where he says one religion is religion, one person's religion doesn't hurt another, Jefferson at the bottom of his own personal copy had written out in Latin the passage from Tertullian, the one that I begin with. And so I live in D.C., and when I came home and I worked at the Library of Congress on this book, I went over and I knew they had at least one copy of Tertullian's works that was owned by Virginia. And I called the book up, and when I opened it up, 17th century edition of Tertullian in Latin, leather bound, small. I turned to the page, and he had actually underlined the passage and put a big X in the margin. I mean, I was just overwhelmed. So I wish that I could have shown a direct link between the formation of Jefferson's ideas in Tertullian, but I couldn't. And so I just put this in an appendix, but it's still pretty exciting for me.
And so we have this tradition, which it seems to me that you're continuing in and of yourself when you write this book, of recovering arguments of the past in a contemporary context. And so you, for example, you quote Thomas Helwys and his notion of not only extending liberty to dissenters within the Christian religion, but also to Muslims outside of it. And to me, that's a very obviously applicable and relevant expansion of the concept of freedom of religion in our modern context here in the 21st century. So do you have any thoughts on how our understanding of the development of freedom of religion as a concept that started as a personal religious conception that broadened by necessity, obviously, into a political conception, how that can inform our world today politically?
Well, I think the point that you just mentioned, Thomas Hell, is, and it has to do with recognizing that liberty of conscience and religious freedom are rights, that not just accommodations by government. And so it's, I think, very significant that ideas which really are formed within the Christian tradition and Christian thinking have an applicability far beyond that. Or to put it another way, one of the things that strikes me when you read Madison and Furneaux and to a lesser extent Locke is that by the 18th century, ideas which had their origins in Christian religious and theological context really stand on their own as human convictions that can be supported without reference to a particular religious tradition. Now, as you know, a few years ago, the University of Chicago philosopher wrote a book, Why Tolerate Religion? And this my phone ringing here. No, let me just... the question is whether... with the decline of Christianity and Christian beliefs and convictions and ideas, you really can support a robust doctrine of religious freedom. Whether and one way to put this is the following. You may have seen it a couple of weeks ago in the an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal by named Aaron Rhodes. And he makes the point, written a book called The Desolation of Rights, that what were once rights that were based on nature, and freedom being one of those, have now been multiplied so that they include whatever any particular political group feels must be included in rights. And so you have a debasement of rights. And so I think that even though I don't talk about natural law, certainly what I develop is based on conception of natural law. And if that is no longer viable, then you really wonder whether you can provide a rationale for rights. The second thing is, and this has to do with jurisprudence, I think really one of the larger conclusions from the book is that religious freedom in its historical development is primarily about the rights of religious communities. But American jurisprudence on these matters is so oriented toward individuals so that it's hard to see, I don't really, of course, know a great deal about the history of American jurisprudence, how you could make a case for the rights of communities on a legal basis. And I think that would be, it seems to me, to be one of the challenges that these ideas present to people who are basically working in law.
So this applicability of the freedom that's needed for communities, because those are often the ones that are targeted legally, is still relevant. And so these debates go on.
Right. The question is whether that has any legal force, but I don't really know. It is interesting to me that there's been almost more interest in the book from political and legal thinkers than from strictly religious thinkers. So that for me has been very illuminating.
Right. Well, of course, the concern about religious dissent or the treatment of religion and references to God in the most abstract and broad ways has been a perennial concern of the courts. With Fifth Abbott, with the question of freedom of religion in the Masterpiece Cake case from the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And so these concerns, both historically and in the historical origins of this debate, inform the contemporary debate, even on the court, Because as Elena Kagan has famously said, in some ways, we're all originalists now, regardless of whether your political stripe is matching Antonin Scalia or not. That was one of the big influences of Scalia, it seems, is to inject into debates about fundamental rights the historical understanding of those rights, whether it's at the founding and sometimes even long before. So I think that I could easily understand why your work, though it doesn't seem to have direct relevance to American jurisprudence in the 21st century, it certainly is of interest to lawyers and people for secular purposes in regard to how religion's treated in the public square.
Thank you very much.
So the book is entitled Liberty in the Things of God, Christian Origins of Religious Freedom, and we've been joined today by its author, Robert Lewis Wilkin. Mr. Wilkin, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.